What if I, and some of you might know this, but what if I were to tell you, some of you might be surprised, that there's actually a whole book of the Bible that doesn't talk about God, doesn't name God, doesn't even name a miracle. For some of you, that would be quite surprising. Others have already read the book of Esther. That's the book we're going to be taking a look at for the next 5 weeks. We're going to take a little break from the book of Romans. But what's interesting about Esther is there's some of the same themes that we've been dealing with in Romans that we see popping up in the book of Esther. Namely, that tension between our responsibility and God's sovereignty. So as we take a look at the book of Esther over the next 5 weeks, we're calling this series Purpose and Providence. And the idea is that these two things go hand in hand. We make decisions. We're obedient. We're trying to pursue God to the best of our ability, all the while God is at work behind the scenes entirely. And so as we look at the book of Esther, yes, God is never mentioned throughout all 10 chapters. And yet we see him at work, not in these huge miraculous events, but these everyday occurrences. And the hope is that we begin to see that pattern in our own lives, that even a lot of the difficult circumstances that we have, as we'll see Esther gets into today, very troubling circumstances, yet we know God is there, even though sometimes we can't see him at work. Let me give you just a little bit of background to kind of set the scene in the book of Esther. This takes place about the 5th century BC after a period of time that we commonly refer to as the exile. The Israelites had been taken captive centuries before up north into the kingdom of Assyria, while the kingdom of Judah, if you remember, there was a split kingdom at this time, that southern kingdom of Judah kind of stayed there, fought off Assyria. But then a new world power came on the scene that overtook Assyria of Babylon. And Babylon and King Nebuchadnezzar came and they ransacked Jerusalem and they took everybody from Judah back into exile, back into Babylon. Well, Babylon didn't make it very long, and a world power by the name of Persia, the Medes and the Persians, overtook Babylon. And as a result, they kind of moved in, and the new king of Persia said, "You guys can go home if you want." And so there was this great edict of Cyrus that sent everybody home that wanted to go home from all these nations that had been taken captive. And the Persian Empire was enormous, as we'll see here in the text of Esther. It stretches from India all the way down into Africa. If you take a look at this map, it's basically from modern-day Pakistan all the way down into the northern tip of Sudan in Africa, reaching up into Turkey, and modern-day Turkey, and even beyond that. It was an enormous empire. All kinds of power, all kinds of people from very different backgrounds. At this time, in about the 4th or 5th century, Greece was really coming on the world scene. And so there was some tension between them and Greece. And this king that we're about to meet, King Xerxes, was actually going to try to overthrow Greece, but never was able. So we set the scene in this way. Apparently, the family that we meet, Esther's family, decided not to go back to Judah. And many people did that. Maybe their lives were there. They were in captivity, yes, but they decided not to go back to their home in Jerusalem. Some went back and rebuilt Jerusalem. That's where we get the books Ezra and Nehemiah. That's what's happening in those books. But others chose to stay. And so we get a sample of what life was like in the capital of Persia from the book of Esther. Let's say a word of prayer, and then we'll jump in and learn about both Esther's purpose, but also God's providence throughout this series. Let's pray. God, as we take a look at this book that you're not named, we know you're there. God, as we look around at our lives and we look back over the last week and maybe even the last month, last year, and we say, I just don't see you, but yet we know you're there. And so God, teach us through the story of Esther, as troubling as it might be sometimes, teach us what it means to rely on you through all the ups and downs of life. God, I pray that you would cause us to change our minds, change our hearts, change our actions about something today, and leave here as different people as a result of interacting with your word. It's in Jesus' name we pray, and amen. So for those of you who haven't made your way through the book of Esther, I'm going to warn you, it's an interesting book. I'm going to give it a PG-13 rating for most of it. It has its ups and downs. Like I said, God isn't mentioned, but we'll be looking at what God is doing in the background throughout this book. So we're going to start today, kind of set the scene, and then we'll pick up where we leave off next week, somewhere in chapter 2. So read with me, if you would, in Esther chapter 1, verse 1. These events happened in the days of King Xerxes, who reigned over 127 provinces stretching from India to Ethiopia. At that time, Xerxes ruled his empire from his royal throne at the fortress of Susa. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. He invited all the military officers of Persia and Media, as well as the princes and nobles of the provinces. The celebration lasted 180 days. A tremendous display of the opulent wealth of his empire and the pomp and splendor of his majesty. When it was over, the king gave a banquet for all the people, from the greatest to the least, who were in the fortress of Susa. It lasted for 7 days and was held in the courtyard of the palace garden. The courtyard was beautifully decorated with white cotton curtains and blue hangings, which were fastened with white linen cords and purple ribbons to silver rings embedded in marble pillars. Gold and silver couches stood on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Drinks were served in gold goblets of many designs, and there was an abundance of royal wine reflecting the king's generosity. By edict of the king, no limits were placed on the drinking, for the king had instructed all his palace officials to serve each man as much as he wanted. So the book of Esther opens with a relatively detailed description. I mean, we even know what the place was decorated like, of a lavish party that lasted for quite some time, thrown by King Xerxes. Most historians believe that Xerxes was probably trying to rally some political support for another invasion of Greece that, interestingly enough, would come a few years after that, where he lost a lot of this wealth. So a lot of the scholars have pointed out there's a bit of irony in here, because most certainly the writer of Esther knew what happened and yet goes to illustrate all of Xerxes' wealth, even though he lost most of this in trying to take over Greece. So he paints him, instead of as a failure, he shows us what it was like at this time. This king, Xerxes, was rich beyond imagination, and the entire kingdom was at his disposal. He oversaw a good portion of the known world. He was a wonderful, powerful force to be reckoned with. But notice something else that Xerxes liked to do that we see about him here. He also really liked to show off this power, didn't he? I mean, what we open up to here is 6 months of 180 days of a military parade, basically. If we look back at the 20th century, we can see all kinds of television examples of dictators who marched out their military might to just show their power and to show all the things that they were able to do that was under their control. And so that's the same thing Xerxes is doing here. And we can't help but notice that everything that's being done by him glorifies one person. Who? Him. It glorifies Xerxes. Everything that's going on, even as he's put no limits on the drinking so that everybody can just party as much as possible, all of that points back to how great of a guy he is. So I do think we need to note here, we look at Xerxes and we see this is such a waste, but he does give us a picture of the human condition. You see, he's not alone in this. We naturally, meaning without Christ in our life, we naturally glorify self. That's exactly what Xerxes is doing here. And so as we're quick to judge him, may we recognize that this happens even still today. We look at this banquet as some petty display of power and wealth. And yet, it still happens. We think, man, boy, Xerxes really needed his ego boosted. Yet, we do the same things even in our culture today. Think about a few of these things. What are our highest paid professions? They're people who can act, sing, or play some sort of sports ball just to entertain us. And they put their lives out there, and we look at their lifestyle, and some people actually say, oh man, I'd love to have a life like that. It's the same thing that we see described here. maybe a little closer to home for us, our cars, our clothes, are both considered extensions of who we are. And we are so often judged based on how new, how trendy, or how expensive those things are. And so sometimes we, even those of us in the middle class or just living here in Pike County, Ohio, make stupid financial decisions just to be able to give the appearance of wealth in these things. We have social media accounts that are set up frequently to feed this mindset. And instead of using those platforms for social good, we so often use them to point back to us and to glorify self. Xerxes is a picture of the human condition. We naturally, in and of our sinful selves, glorify us, ourself. We aren't that different apart from Christ, from Xerxes. And this opening banquet is just a picture of the kind of worldly kingdoms that we who follow Christ are called to avoid. In fact, that's the next thing I want you to see, is that these kind of kingdoms we see as we turn into the New Testament teachings of Christ, they're worthless, they're meaningless. Worldly kingdoms that we see pictured here, like Xerxes, and we're going to continue to build on this theme. It's meaningless. This is not a godly kingdom, as you will see. And so we have to go into this book of Esther realizing what is being described here is an incredibly worldly kingdom that is focused on that king and enable him to glorify and gratify himself. Let's go on in verse 9. So while this party was going on, at the same time, Queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day of the feast, when King Xerxes was in high spirits because of the wine, read drunk, he told the seven eunuchs who attended him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carsus, to bring Queen Vashti to him with the royal crown on her head. He wanted the nobles and all the other men to gaze on her beauty, for she was a very beautiful woman. But when they conveyed the king's order to Queen Vashti, she refused to come. This made the king furious, and he burned with anger. So in the middle of this lavish party, while Xerxes and all of his so-called friends that his money had bought were partying and were living it up and were drunk, he decides it's time to show off his wife. The ultimate trophy. Not only is he richer and more powerful than everybody else, he also has the prize of the most beautiful wife in the land, and he wants to show her off. And so he summons for her. It's just one problem. Vashti said, enough is enough. I can't deal with this anymore. She had to know the consequences. She had to know that consequences would come for disobeying the king of Persia. And yet she says, no. You can't drag me there. I'm not coming. I'm done with this. This left Xerxes more than a little upset. Not only is he disappointed that he didn't get to show her off, but even more, she made a fool of him in front of everybody when he's trying to exert and give this appearance of power, and he can't even get his wife to come and say hi to everybody. He's embarrassed that his wife disobeyed him in front of all of these people. So something had to be done. Verse 13. He immediately consulted with his wise advisors who knew all the Persian laws and customs, for he always asked their advice. The names of these men were Karshina, Sheshthar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, seven nobles of Persia and Media. They met with the king regularly and held the highest position in the empire. What must be done to Queen Vashti, the king demanded. What penalty does the law provide for a queen who refuses to obey the king's orders, properly sent through his eunuchs? Memucan answered the king and his nobles, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also every noble and citizen throughout your empire. Women everywhere will begin to despise their husbands when they learn that Queen Vashti has refused to appear before the king. Before this day is out, the wives of all the king's nobles throughout Persia and Media will hear what the queen did and start treating their husbands the same way. There will be no end to their contempt and anger. So if it please the king, we suggest that you issue a written decree, a law of the Persians and Medes that cannot be revoked. It should order that Queen Vashti be forever banished from the presence of King Xerxes, and that the king should choose another queen more worthy than she. When this decree is published throughout the king's vast empire, husbands everywhere, whatever their rank, will receive proper respect from their wives. The king and his nobles thought this made good sense, so he followed Memucan's counsel. He sent letters to all parts of the empire, to each province in its own script and language, proclaiming that every man should be the ruler of his own home and should say whatever he pleases. Yeah, you guys are having fun with this, aren't you? Xerxes' counselors were worried that what would happen if word got out that a woman stood up to her husband, especially the first lady, the queen. They feared that every relationship in the kingdom would be turned upside down and women would be emboldened and begin to stand up for themselves. So they advised Xerxes to shut it down and be done with Vashti. This is an interesting part of the story, and so many people over the years have tried to take it from as an example of maybe women, you need to submit, or hey, women, look, you need to stand up for yourselves. And honestly, neither are really there. We don't have motives behind this. We don't have what's going on. I mean, there have been plenty of people over the years that have tried to paint Vashti as a villain and reinforce that a husband needs to be at the head of the house from this story. Please don't do that. This is a horrible story. What he was asking her to do was not godly. It was not humble. It was not servant leadership at all. It's disgusting and vile. And so don't even begin to think about this story that way, please. And other people have lifted up Vashti as a hero that provides an example. I don't know. Maybe she is. Maybe she should have stood up for herself. The problem is the story doesn't really give us these motives, doesn't tell us how to look at this. So all we know is that Xerxes tried to get his wife to come and she said no. It isn't meant to be an example of marital relationships. Thank God. That's not what's being taught in Esther here. But what we do see, however, is another part of human nature. Not only do we like naturally to glorify self, naturally speaking, we really enjoy control, don't we? We like being in control. Naturally speaking, apart from Christ, we want the control to be in our hands. We want to be doing what we want to be doing all the time. And so we see that in this story, whether it's Vashti, who says enough is enough and disobeys the king, knowing there'll be some natural consequences, or Xerxes, who has to maintain this illusion of his power. Yes, he oversees half of the known world, but he can't even get his wife to come to a banquet. Or the advisors that are worried about their own relationships. We see it again and again. We like to be in control. We do everything we can to make our own will and our own desires happen. Remember, whose glory do we primarily work for naturally? Our own. And so the natural conclusion of that is we strive to be in control so that the best things that are for us can happen to us. And so we strive to maintain control of our jobs and our spouses, and our kids, and our finances, and even our health. We think we can control all of these things. And when we lose that control, we're sent, a lot like Xerxes, into fits of rage. We can't believe that we've lost control. So as we close this first chapter of Esther, we can see this picture of human nature. We tend to glorify self. We have to stop and remind ourselves of those kingdoms that end up with those who can glorify themselves, end up just empty. They're meaningless. But we also see that we naturally want control. No matter if we're in a good situation or a bad situation, if we have power or we don't have power, we crave control. Unfortunately, as we're going to continue to see, that's not the case. In this first chapter of Esther, we can see who is in control of this earthly kingdom. It is clear, and that's what the author is trying to establish, how powerful this man Xerxes actually is. I mean, this edict was put out over the entire kingdom of Persia. So Xerxes is a man who has all this wealth and power and has the entire kingdom at his command. We see this almost absolute power that he possesses, and we see how he decides to use that absolute power. Let me take an aside real quick, and then we'll get back to the book of Esther. I just want to flip over to the Gospels just for a little bit of relief and contrast this kingdom with Christ's kingdom. We look at this picture of how Xerxes handled this almost absolute power, and then we read this of Jesus Christ in Matthew 20, what he tells his disciples in Matthew 20, 25. But Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must become your slave. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Having read Esther chapter 1, isn't this just an incredible, refreshing reminder of what the kingdom of Christ looks like? We are not called to these worldly kingdoms. We are called to follow Jesus Christ, and things are different in Christ's kingdom. As his followers, we are called to give up power by serving other people and actually taking the lowly position on purpose and serving others, not seeking it for ourselves, just as Jesus Christ did. So obviously, getting back to the story in Esther now, that's not what's happening in Xerxes' life. Everything points back to him. Xerxes has a new problem, though, that his advisors are going to seek to solve for him, in that he misses having a queen. Let's look at chapter 2. But after Xerxes' anger had subsided, he began thinking about Vashti and what she had done and the decree that he had made. So his personal attendants suggested, "Let us search the empire to find beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint agents in each province to bring these beautiful young women into the royal harem at the fortress of Susa. Haggai, the king's eunuch in charge of the harem, will see that they are all given beauty treatments. After that, the young woman who pleases the king will be made queen instead of Vashti." This advice was very appealing to the king, so he put the plan into effect. Interesting advisors he has here, huh? Instead of advising the king to apologize and reconcile with his wife, as probably would have been really good advice, the king's advisors now basically say, "Forget her and let's get you a newer model." They decide to find the most beautiful young women and bring them in for a test drive for the king. It's this very situation that we meet this young lady named Esther. Look at verse 5. "At that time, there was a Jewish man in the fortress of Susa whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair. He was from the tribe of Benjamin and was a descendant of Kish and Shimei. His family had been among those who, with King Jehoiachin of Judah, had been exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. This man had a very beautiful and lovely young cousin, Hadassah, who was also called Esther. When her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her into his family and raised her as his own daughter. As a result of the king's decree, Esther, along with many other young women, was brought to the king's harem at the fortress of Susa and placed in Haggai's care. Haggai was very impressed with Esther and treated her kindly. He quickly ordered a special menu for her and provided her with beauty treatments. He also assigned her 7 maids specially chosen from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Esther had not told anyone of her nationality and family background because Mordecai had directed her not to do so. Every day, Mordecai would take a walk near the courtyard of the harem to find out about Esther and what was happening to her." So this is no doubt a troubling situation for this very young lady named Esther. She'd already lost her parents, doesn't say how, but she is an orphan now. being raised by her cousin, older cousin Mordecai, and we find out they are indeed Jewish. Their family had been taken from Judah. They worshipped the one true God, Yahweh, and must have chosen for some reason or another to stay in Persia rather than to go back to the Jerusalem that is being rebuilt. And so Esther is one of many young ladies chosen to be taken into the palace. And so I want you to understand all of what is happening here, because too often we sanitize this, especially from the eyes of a young lady and her guardian. This is not some sort of Miss Persia pageant that they decided to enter Esther in with hopes of a better life for her someday. No, she has been made to come to the palace against her will, against Mordecai's will. This was an order of the king, and she was one of the many selected. When she gets there, she happens to be well-liked by the eunuch in charge of the harem, and so he gives her special favor, but she does not reveal that she is Jewish because Mordecai told her not to. And so she does her best to cover that up, fitting in with the dress, fitting in with the customs, probably eating the same food that everybody else ate and ignoring the laws that she had been taught as a Jewish girl. Mordecai is quite worried about her, I'm sure, and checks on her daily. Probably never gets to see her during this 1 year period that she's in this harem, but he's constantly asking, "Can you tell me about Esther and what's going on? I'm worried about her." He's probably worried sick about what's happening to this young lady. Verse 12, we hear a little bit more about their preparation. It says, "Before each young woman was taken to the king's bed, she was given the prescribed 12 months of beauty treatments, 6 months with oil of myrrh, followed by 6 months with special perfumes and ointments. When it was time for her to go to the king's palace, she would be given her choice of whatever clothing or jewelry she wanted to take from the harem. And so that evening, the young lady would be taken to the king's private rooms, and the next morning she'd be brought to the second harem, where the king's wives lived. There she would be under the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch in charge of the concubines. She would never go to the king again unless he had especially enjoyed her and requested her by name. Esther was the daughter of Abihail, who was Mordecai's uncle, and Mordecai had adopted this younger cousin, Esther. When it was Esther's turn to go to the king, she accepted the advice of Haggai, the eunuch in charge of the harem. She asked for nothing except what he suggested, and she was admired by everyone who saw her." The story, when you read it this way, and you read it every word, it makes you want to cry with what's happening. Young Esther spent a year in the king's harem being beautified, probably fattened up a little, awaiting her night with the king. If that king did not find her satisfying on that one night, she would simply go back to the harem with all the concubines to live out the rest of her days removed from her family. It's not like she got returned back home. Her life was pretty much over at this point. And if she tried to resist the king's request and say, "No, I cannot do this," she most assuredly would have been put to death. So Esther's put in quite the decision here. She decided to go along with her situation and make the most of it, and even sought the advice of the eunuch Haggai. Verse 16, we find out that her night finally came. Esther was taken to King Xerxes at the royal palace in early winter of the 7th month of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than any of the other young women. He was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti. To celebrate the occasion, he gave a great banquet in Esther's honor for all of his nobles and officials, declaring a public holiday for the provinces and giving generous gifts to everyone. So Esther, we see here, had pleased the king to such a degree that he decided to make her queen instead of Vashti. He was so taken with her that he threw another banquet to show her off to the nobles, to show, "Look at my new wife, and I honor her, and we're making a holiday out of this. She is now queen over Persia." And so first, we have to pause here and recognize this incredibly strange twist in what's happening. There's going to be twists throughout this book. In fact, if there's one theme throughout this book other than banquets, there's going to be a lot of banquets. It's that there's always this reversal of fortune, the stuff that you don't expect. And that's the kind of stuff that we say, what is going on here? And so in this case, this strange twist, a poor orphaned Jewish girl is now queen over half of the known world. What in the world just happened? Well, how does this unfold like this? Why did this happen? Someone from poverty, I mean, a rags to riches story if you want to look at it, but a disgusting one when you look at the details. And so what in the world are we to make of this story? I mean, we can pause here and go ahead and ask the question, what in the world is this doing in the Bible? First of all, what Xerxes did here was pure evil. He's continually painted as an evil king. Please do not forget that in the coming chapters. What was done here was disgusting. And for the record, it wasn't necessarily just sexist, because it wasn't just young girls whose lives he had ruined. There's also a record that he would regularly take young boys from their homes, have them castrated, and put them into service as eunuchs. Why? Because he is the most powerful man in the land, and everything is done for his glory and for his gratification. That's the man who is being painted here that we see named Xerxes. But in all this, now you have Mordecai and Esther, a couple of Jewish people who decided to completely blend into the culture around them, where Mordecai had to remind Esther, remember, we're trying to keep it secret that we're Jewish. I'm not sure how we'd be treated if everybody knew that. And so let's keep that on the down low. And so they're thrown into this situation where they are completely out of control. That's kind of what we see from this story, isn't it? Yes, naturally we want control, but let's be honest. We rarely get it. We are rarely in control. And I know that's a depressing sermon point. But that is one of the points of this story. I mean, that's kind of where Esther finds herself. She's not in control of this situation. She doesn't know what decision to make. She doesn't know what to do. She's torn here. She doesn't want to go through either of it. She's just put in an awful situation. She is not in control. Esther and Mordecai recognize their situation, and I guess they did the best they could in the moment. Did they do the right thing? I have no idea. As I look at this story, I would lean towards no. It doesn't seem like they did the right thing. But it's easy for us to judge the situations of others and want to declare they acted right and they acted wrong. And sometimes we just can't do that, because we've got to recognize sometimes things are out of our hands. Esther was kind of put into an impossible situation here. My biggest beef with them, what are we to make of them hiding their faith in God? I mean, are we to make them out to be heroes in this way? I mean, contrast this with Daniel. If you've read the book of Daniel, Daniel's in a very similar situation. He's in a kingdom, been taken from his home, and yet he decides to make his Jewish faith known to everybody. He praises Yahweh. He rejects the king's feasts and foods and eats only vegetables. And it can even be seen praying to Yahweh in public, even though it was commanded against. Daniel took a very different route here. He did not go with the flow. He went against the flow. Esther went the other direction. Contrast this also with Joseph from his story that we see from the end of Genesis. We see him put into a similar sexual temptation when Potiphar's wife calls him in and asks him to sleep with her. And he flees. He takes off only to be lied about and ends up in prison as a result of that. Esther went in a different direction. Yet in all of these situations, what we have to see is nothing knocks God off of his throne. We can read and read about how powerful Xerxes was, but he can't even touch the sovereignty of God. God is using this horrible situation, this awful circumstance, for their ultimate good. We call that providence. God working behind the scenes. God working when we can't see him at work, when we wonder why certain things happen the way they have. We can trust in God's providence. That nothing surprises God, that some of the situations are not ideal, they're not even godly, and yet he allows them to occur, and he is still on his throne. Remember Romans 8, we just read it a few weeks ago, 8:28. It's this promise, and we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose for them. Notice it doesn't say God will cause everything to work together the way that his people want. Because sometimes we are put in difficult situations where, let's be honest, that's this world, isn't it? I mean, this is a picture of the world we live in, that so often we're put into no-win situations. We so desperately want a black and white world where things are so clear and we can walk forward following our God. But this world stands in opposition to the people of God at every step. We have to remember that. Whether it was back in Israel or today in those who claim the name of Christ, this world stands in opposition to what we believe and what we want to follow. But that doesn't mean God isn't there and isn't working. It's a tough pill to swallow when you look at this situation and you see the unsanitized version of it and you say, this is disgusting. Why would a God allow something like this to happen? Isn't that the questions we ask today that we struggle with and we shake our fist at God? Where were you? Why did you allow this to happen? And as a pastor, I so often wish I could answer that question, but I just can't. All I can say is, I know that he is God and we are not. And he has promised that he'll work everything, even the nasty, disgusting, horrible circumstances of life, out for our good, for those who are called according to his purpose. I encourage you to come back next week to see how God is going to work in and through Esther. Even in the midst of her being out of control, we'll continue to see this story unfold. And all of it, you say, wow, I really see the hand of God moving through this. Even though nothing out of the ordinary happens, it's just all these circumstantial things. You can see God at work. And so come back next week as we find out about a plot against the Jews. So how do we close this up today? As we turn the spotlight on our own lives, what do we take from this? Well, perhaps you're someone in here who right now feels out of control. You look at your life and you say, my finances, my job, my relationships, my health, I feel so out of control. Well, allow this to be your reminder that A, you're not alone, and B, God is still on his throne. Yes, life can feel out of control. It can feel like you're put into circumstances that don't seem fair. And I think that's the next thing that we have to see. Perhaps you have been put into a no-win situation at some point in your life. And you look back and you see shame or guilt or fear as a result of that situation. And you say, it wasn't fair what happened to me. Yeah, I agree. It shouldn't have happened. And yet we see here, it doesn't knock God off of his throne. I don't know why he allowed that to happen. But we see that God is still in control. And so perhaps you're in a no-win situation right now. I encourage you to trust in God. Trust in God for the big picture and recognize the kingdom of this world is indeed disgusting. But that's not your kingdom anymore. And that's not your king. Perhaps today the follow-up for you as you shine the spotlight on your life isn't one of those things, but it's a recognition that you've been chasing a very worldly kingdom. You've been after everything that this world holds dear. You try to get all the money you can. You pursue all of the material possessions you can. You pursue all of the power you can. You pursue the sexual gratification in whatever way you possibly can. And all of it, you just get so proud of, and it glorifies you, and then you post everything on social media, and that's just the pattern you've fallen into because that's the kingdom of our world. Well, if that's the case, I encourage you to come to Christ today. Because I want to point something out. You remember how empty you started that pursuit when you started going after all those things of the world? Ask yourself honestly, are you any more full now? You're just as empty as when you started. Because all of those things fall short of satisfaction. Because what we desire deep down is a relationship with our God and our Father. And there's only one thing that can bring us back to that, and that's Jesus Christ. So I encourage you, if you're pursuing all those worldly things, and you say, wow, the character I was most like in this story is Xerxes. Well, you're not alone in that either. Recognize that you do naturally want that control, and you do naturally glorify yourself. But say, it's time to stop pursuing vain ambitions, empty promises, and instead, I'm going to start pursuing Christ. If that's you today, I encourage you to come talk to me or Val, or grab that Connect card in the back of your chair and say, today I want to start following Jesus Christ. I want to start following a king that is worth it and that has an upside down kingdom to what this world is. So what is your response today? Maybe you're that person that needs to come to Christ. Maybe you've already come to Christ, but you've recognized, man, God's allowed a lot of junk to happen in my life. Why is that? Well, let's have a conversation with Esther. She couldn't have known what was going on in this time. I mean, she doesn't have the end of the story. I mean, I don't think she's necessarily saying, well, maybe I'll be put in a better position someday to be able to save my people. No, she's got none of that, guys. She is a scared young lady that doesn't know what to do. And yet God is with her. Recognize that in your situation. You're scared. Maybe you feel shame or guilt. Life isn't exactly the way you would have wanted it to be. And yet recognize that God is in control. And God is God. How do you respond to that sort of thing? With worship. With just recognizing and humbling yourself. Kneeling your heart. Kneeling your life and saying, God, I recognize you're in control and not me. And so I'm going to trust you, and I'm going to look forward to that day that I can live in your kingdom instead of this world's kingdom. So let's stand and let's sing together today in response.